I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Being different is what competitive strategy is all about, and that's true for cities as well as businesses. One thing that differentiates one city from another is its mix of independent businesses. Our guests today have special insight into business startups and business ownership. Dr. Heike Meyer is a professor and researcher at Virginia Tech, whose work focuses on entrepreneurs, particularly women entrepreneurs and those in high tech. David Weinstein runs the Chicagoland Entrepreneurial Center, where he helps new businesses find financing and connect to customers. We'll talk about how local businesses get started and grow and how they change cities today on Smart City. But first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Dr. Heike Meyer is an assistant professor in the Department of Urban Affairs and Planning at Virginia Tech. Her research interests include regional economic development and the evolution of high-technology regions. She received her doctorate in urban studies at Portland State University, where her work focused on the evolution of Portland's high-technology industry in the absence of a research university. Her current work focuses on entrepreneurs, particularly women business owners. Heike, you study women's business ownership. Tell me, why does it matter?
Carol, I think it's really an exciting time for women because they are becoming an increasingly important economic force. And especially during the 90s, we saw high levels of women's entrepreneurship, and they've become very successful at it. I think we have now about 10 million firms that have at least 50% or more ownership by women, and that's an estimate from the Center for Women's Business Research. And they have started firms at twice the rate than men did, so they are a little bit more risk-taking than men, and they outperform the rest of the economy, both in terms of employment increases and sales growth. So I think they've become really important to our economies, and especially the urban and regional economies. And I think they're not just your boutique shops or nail shops or hair salons that people might think of women's owned businesses, but they're increasingly entering the non-traditional sectors. High-tech firms, construction, utilities, manufacturing firms. We are beginning to see many more women entering these kind of non-traditional fields. And some people have called it the new generation of women entrepreneurs because they are getting more and more advanced degrees, such as MBAs, engineering, science degrees, and they are getting more exposed to professional and managerial experience. So they are really well equipped for these kind of sectors that are non-traditional in a sense. So in a way, I call it the matriarch economy because we might see some changes also with women becoming more leaders in the corporate sector. We see that women's firms are more gender equitable. They employ more women. They also have a little bit more flexible work schedules. They adjust more to work-life issues. And maybe in return, we see them being a little bit more innovative because they have more voices on the table. Women are becoming more engaged in decision-making and innovative processes. And that's important for being competitive as a region, as a city.
I want to talk to you about many of those things, but let me come back to this number you use, 10 million firms that are 50% or more owned by women. What percentage of all firms would that be? If you look at the number of women's businesses in the context of the overall economy, what does that look like?
I think the 10 million number is about 48% of all privately held firms.
Really?
Now, these are all... Yeah, and about 6.7 million are 51% or more owned by women. So those are the majority-owned women, and they are about 30%. So it's really a large number of firms.
What do we know about women as business owners? You talked about their businesses having more gender equity, being more tolerant of flexible work schedules, and being more innovative because there's more diversity among team members or employees in those firms. Are there other things that you've been able to uncover in your study of women as business owners?
Yeah, I think the most important point is that women are on many factors really not different from men in terms of leading firms and why they get into entrepreneurship. They're in it for the money as well as the fun. And so in that sense, they're eager to grow their businesses at the same level as men do. So we don't have too many differences on the individual level. At the organizational level, I think we see, as you mentioned before, the gender equity. Women are more likely to employ women. So we will see a little bit more of an equal labor force in these firms. In terms of their organizational cultures, I think women are more in tune to the needs that other women might have if they become mothers, for example. I know of one firm, for example, Oregon Chai in Portland, Oregon. The founders are all women, and one of the original founders, Heather Howitt, she used to bring her dog to work and her son and would go for runs in Forest Park to break up her long day. So you see kind of more a relaxed style of maybe management, and that's in turn much more conducive to women that have families and needs for that.
Is it good, though, for business?
I think so, because in a way you're introducing a more flexible work schedule. And also, if you look maybe at the regional level, you know, there's a lot of theories about how it's important for companies to network with each other, because you have the transfer of ideas and knowledge, and there's all these anecdotes about Silicon Valley, how important the pubs and restaurants are where the engineers hang out and exchange ideas about the latest software. If you have a business that's a little bit more conducive to work-life balance, maybe women have more of a better chance to hang out in the evening and maybe in exchange stay at home the next day or so. So I think there is a benefit to it, yes.
Do you think, though, that women who are, for instance, in the midst of raising families have the time for networking? On the one hand, I can understand, and you and Joe Courtright have done a lot of work on, you know, in that area, looking at the value of those places that bring people together to exchange ideas, which then cause innovation and improvement. But I'm just wondering, are women as good at that as men, particularly women who are busy raising their families and working?
Mm-hmm. I think I painted a very rosy picture so far, and I think there's a lot to improve, and especially when it comes to networking. And what we see with professional networking, there's a very interesting fact. It's when you ask men and women about who makes up their network, their professional network. Women include men into their network, but they also include families and friends. They're very more holistic than men in terms of who they would go to for advice. Now, if you go to the men and ask them for what makes up their network, it's a very different picture. Men include men, and they don't include that many women. So when it comes to entrepreneurship and business success, it has a lot of implications, because if you think about fast-growing women-owned high-tech businesses, that is the need for financing. If a venture capitalist, and the majority of them are still men, don't think about women or don't have them in their network, then the women entrepreneur who is looking for venture capital has probably a very hard time to access these networks. So it's very difficult in that sense if women are not included in the male-dominant sort of economy and the networks there. So in a sense, we still have a lot of hurdles that women have to take, and it's not all as rosy as maybe the numbers will sound.
Have you seen cities that are addressing the challenge that you just described, that of men not including women in their networks? Are there companies or cities even where you see that being addressed?
No, I haven't seen any cities, and I think it would be a very important economic development priority to address, because women are becoming much more important as economic players, and not only women, but also immigrants in general. And if we don't include them, we are missing out a big talent pool. But I haven't seen any cities that are doing, you know, explicitly strategies for women. I know a couple of nonprofit organizations. There's one called Springboard, and they were founded in 2000, and they basically organize venture capital forums for women entrepreneurs to present their business plans, and they had tremendous success. They had over 3,500 applications. 5 firms that were founded have gone public so far, so they're good return on investment, and they hold hold these forums in different regions, primarily in the East, Midwest, in California. So they are providing a platform for women to connect with investors and service providers. The other organization I know is more at the community level. It's in Fairfax County in Northern Virginia, and they are called the Community Business Partners, and they have a Center for Women's Business, and they hold classes about how to finance your business. And I think they are more on the other spectrum of the smaller growing businesses. But in general, I think it's left really to these nonprofits to support women and not so much at the city or regional level.
Mm-hmm. Are women's patterns of business ownership, Heike, different than those of men? Do women tend to be in certain industries and concentrated there?
Yes. Traditionally, women have started businesses in retail, personal services, education, things that were more closer to their educational tracking, I would say. But now we are seeing them entering more the non-traditional fields, as they have also entered more programs in universities that are in computer science, biotechnology, some engineering and other physical sciences, but less so than the others that I mentioned. But overwhelmingly, we see them really in the traditional sectors that are also your slower growing sectors. And then within high tech, I'm kind of seeing, from what I'm studying right now, sort of bunching up of the women in what I call the female-typed high-tech sectors. Those are the consulting services, maybe some software services, biotechnology, but not really in your manufacturing, semiconductor manufacturing, more the male-dominant kind of high-tech sectors. So we also see sort of a dichotomy here in that area.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Dr. Heike Meyer. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Urban Affairs and Planning at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University. I want to come back to this notion, Heike, of cities providing an encouraging environment for women and women entrepreneurs. As you know, your often colleague Joe Courtwright has just done a study for CEOs for Cities called The Young and Restless in a Knowledge Economy. And in that study, he points out very dramatically the growing importance of women to cities and their success because of the fact that the number of young women now having completed college degrees, the rate at which they're completing exceeds men. In fact, their actual numbers now exceed those of men. And so cities are going to have to find a way to attract and keep young college-educated women if they want to have successful economies. In your study of what you call the matriarch economy, is there anything that points the way, Heike, for an urban leader who wants to make his or her city encouraging to young women, either, again, as employees or employers?
That's a very difficult question. I think, in general, women like places where they are accepted and embraced. And if you can create an environment that's tolerant to different thinkers, and that's in general, I think, for entrepreneurs, a valid kind of environment that you need to create, because an entrepreneur is somebody who thinks differently and wants to make a difference and change the world. So if your place can provide an environment that's conducive to different kind of thinking and accepting of different kind of thinking, and that's for women important as well, then you will foster entrepreneurship, and especially women's entrepreneurship. So that's an important aspect. The other thing, I think, is this networking issue. And we've seen a lot of these women organizations emerge. Women in Technology Industries, for instance, has a very large following and local chapters. And Springboard is a very good example. But they seem to provide services and help from women for women. But I think it's also important that women connect to the mainstream economy, to other men-owned businesses. So what I could think about is mentoring and coaching, connecting these high-growth women businesses to the high-growth sectors that you have in your economy and the male-owned businesses. So that seems to be a very important issue that could be addressed by leaders.
You've also studied bootstrapping, high tech, and economic success in second-tier regions. It's generally assumed that places that are going to have a robust high tech economy must have a world-class university and ample venture capital. True?
No, it's actually not true, because I'm looking at cities that have been successful in growing high-tech economies without these necessary prerequisites, such as a world-class university or high levels of venture capital. One of them is Portland again, the other is Kansas City, and people would raise their eyebrow, well, these two places. Well, Portland, what happened there was really that it used companies as surrogate universities, and over time, Tektronix and Intel fostered the creation of lots of entrepreneurship. They attracted a workforce and talent and developed this talent, and also they provided innovation. So the three functions of a university. So these firms really have substituted the university. And over time also you had sort of an entrepreneurial innovative milieu formed. Kansas City is a similar case. In Kansas City, you had in the 50s a very important pharmaceutical company called Marion Laboratories. Actually, its founder is the founder of the Kauffman Foundation that's now very supportive of entrepreneurship. And Marion Laboratories was very successful at developing and marketing drugs and medicine. But it didn't do research in drug development. Over time, Marion was bought up and changed and declined. But what was left was really this talented workforce of people that know how to develop and market drugs. And they founded new companies that are focusing on developing drugs. And now they also have the Star Wars Institute, which is a $2 billion endowed research organization that is private and can help them with the research. So Kansas City, in essence, is really in a very good place if they can figure out how to connect these entrepreneurs that know how to develop and market drugs with the researchers at Star Wars. So in both cases, we see that these second-tier cities can essentially bootstrap their high-tech economies without having a Stanford or MIT or, you know, a lot of venture capital. Washington, D.C. is another case, a little bit more mature and older, where the federal government actually played this role of the surrogate universities by outsourcing a lot of business opportunities and thereby giving market opportunities to small firms in the high-tech sector. Yeah, in all three cases, you have really the success in the absence of the Silicon Valley model.
That's fascinating to me. Is there something about the firms that are these surrogate universities, if you will, is there something about those firms that actively encourages entrepreneurship among its employees, or is it more a fact of their spending externally to enliven the economy, if you will, to their own benefit?
I think it's in the Kansas and the Portland case, it was crisis. Companies changed and restructured and laid off people. People wanted to stick around in the community and found new opportunities. So it wasn't that much of an intentional effort on behalf of the company. But it was also sort of a culture in these companies that wanted to attract the best and the brightest in the field. So in Marion Laboratories, they attracted really good salespeople and marketing people. In the case of Tektronix in Portland, they had really good engineers that knew how to tinker with all these different ideas. So in both cases, you had sort of the merging of talent base plus some kind of crisis situation that helped. So I think, in a way, if you can attract or keep companies that are very eager to get really at the cutting edge of things, you will attract or develop this kind of labor pool that's necessary for, hopefully, for entrepreneurship.
Let's shift subjects a minute. You've been watching the slow city movement in Germany. Tell me, what is the slow city movement and how you see its significance to cities in general?
The slow city movement is a spin-off from the slow food movement, which started in the late 80s in Italy. It's sort of a movement that values quality food, seasonal organic food. It was started in Italy against McDonald's intrusion into Rome. And the slow cities is a spin-off that began in the early 2000s, I think. It has about 60 cities in Italy, 3 in Germany, 2 in England, 1 in Norway. So it's a very European movement. And these cities place a heavy emphasis on hospitality and conviviality, but also on sustainability, environmental, economic, and social sustainability. And I think the significance of the movement is really its ideas that you can gain economic growth with sort of a qualitative aspect of being slow and being alternative rather than attracting the next best thing by giving a lot of incentives. These cities have developed programs where they connect local farmers to the restaurants. You go to a restaurant, you have a local menu, and you know where all the ingredients come from. They protect their pasture lands because they see in them a value of open space and usage for old heirloom apple trees, for example, making organic apple juice out of them and selling it. So it's really this unique combination of trying to protect what they have, historical roots in the environment and the landscape and the cultural landscape, with the local economy, and not so much trying to achieve, you know, what everybody else is trying to achieve, mega projects or incentives and sort of your traditional economic development. And in the European cases, it's very interesting. They are doing it because they realize that, you know, with the European Union and the integration there, cities see that they have to come back to their roots and preserve some kind of identity in the face of becoming more and more integrated.
Do you think, Heike, that this has applicability to the U.S.?
Yes, I think so, because you have towns here, for instance, college towns, that have a, you know, fairly well off maybe socioeconomic level, innovative leadership in these towns that could adopt some ideas. Portland, Oregon, again, is not a case where you see some environmental sustainability introduced into urban planning. You have some movements along the community-supported agriculture and in terms of preserving open space and family farms. So you have a lot of movements. It might be a little bit more difficult to get to the overarching umbrella at the city level of becoming a slow city. I mean, they are also made fun of, these slow cities. They are asked, oh, does your mayor walk slow and does your administration work slow? So maybe people might be hesitant to become slow cities.
But it's an interesting idea perhaps to try at a sub-city level.
I think so, in neighborhoods. I think with the community economic development movement, nonprofits focusing on local economies and what you can do, there are elements of this movement, especially connecting social, economic, environmental issues that are definitely applicable, yeah.
Heike, thanks so much for being with us on Smart City. It's great to finally meet you.
Thanks for inviting me.
Dr. Heike Meyer is assistant professor in the Department of Urban Affairs and Planning at Virginia Tech. After a short break, we'll return to talk to Otis White about the latest news from cities, and we'll find out how Chicago's Dan Weinstein is encouraging that city's entrepreneurs. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, I've always believed that a great mayor can turn a city around, and you found one city that proves it. The city is Oakland. The mayor is Jerry Brown.
Boy, Jerry Brown kind of defines the term different drummer, doesn't he? He's done everything. He's been the governor of California. He ran for president 3 times. He has this mysterious Zen-like character. And you may remember when he was governor back in the 70s of California, the press dubbed him Governor Moonbeam because he was such an unusual character. And maybe the strangest step of his long political career came in 1998 when he suddenly popped up in Oakland, California. Now, Oakland is kind of the ugly duckling city that's across the bay from San Francisco, popped up in this old declining industrial city and announced that he wanted to be the mayor. And the citizens seemed so stunned that anybody of Jerry Brown's stature would want to be mayor that they elected him overwhelmingly, although he didn't have very deep roots in the community. The funny thing is, though, that Brown's celebrity seems to have dramatically helped Oakland. And to understand that, you have to sort of step back and look at Oakland and look at cities like Oakland. The great thing that Oakland has always had going for it is that it's very close to San Francisco. People drive long distances to work in San Francisco, and they drive around Oakland because it had such a bad reputation for crime and corruption and so on. And simply by becoming the mayor of Oakland, Jerry Brown seems to have acted like a gigantic advertisement for the place. When he became mayor, he announced that he wanted to build enough new housing in Oakland to attract 10,000 people, and that just seemed impossible. No new housing had been built there in so long, nobody could imagine that there would ever be such an amount of housing built. Well, in fact, while Brown has been mayor, they've either built or begun construction on 7,370 new units, which is enough to house 12,000 people. So he's going to exceed his goal of bringing 10,000 new residents to Oakland. Now, so you might ask the question, so how does this work? My own feeling about this is the impact of a celebrity endorsement. He is almost the celebrity mayor of Oakland. And the thinking seems to be from folks, listen, if a guy like Jerry Brown can live and work in Oakland, you know, maybe there's a reason for me to move there too. And that seems to have been just the spur that Oakland needs. And it seems to be now coming back with new residents and new housing being built there. Something you couldn't have imagined before Mayor Moonbeam popped up in Oakland.
Confidence is a magical thing in cities, isn't it?
It is absolutely necessary. And just like it is in an economy, and Oakland seems to have benefited from Jerry Brown's endorsement.
Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
David Weinstein is CEO of Chicagoland Entrepreneurial Center, an affiliate of the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce. David is a former entrepreneur in the fields of technology and consulting. He was also senior technology advisor to the mayor of the city of Chicago from 1998 to 2000, where he co-founded the Mayor's Council of Technology. David, tell me about the work of the Chicagoland Entrepreneurial Center.
Basically, we're a nonprofit that's set up to help emerging entrepreneurs secure clients and raise capital. We focus on four sectors primarily, which is retail, restaurants, technology, and professional services. And we've been around for about 4 years, and we're affiliated with the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce.
What kind of encouragement and support do entrepreneurs need?
They always need some emotional support because it's always a tough row. Having run myself two businesses and also failed in one of them, you always got to stick with the business. So there's an emotional level as well as what they really need is access to clients. You can do the best business planning and operational planning, but give an entrepreneur an opportunity to do business, and that's really the greatest thing you can do for them.
How do you provide that access to clients?
We do direct one-on-one introductions. So with many of our companies, whether it's an introduction to a mentor or a direct introduction to a targeted account, we will actually use our relationships that we have and actually make those direct introductions.
When you say entrepreneurs need access to clients, is that what they often miss?
Well, I don't think it's what they miss, but I think in the first couple years of running a business, so again, for emerging entrepreneurs, the number one thing is access to clients. So anything that you can do to help them gain access, whether that's a direct introduction or a direct lead, that's the greatest thing you can do for somebody who's just starting up a business. More mature businesses obviously have a base of clients, and they're often just trying to upsell services to them. But emerging entrepreneurs, they generally need to win new business.
Is money an issue? Venture capital, startup capital?
Without question. I would say directly tied with clients is capital. You know, all entrepreneurs need capital. Depending on the type of business, whether it's a high growth business, often before they see profits, they're going to need some form of capital. Sometimes that's in the form of equity. We generally encourage entrepreneurs to syndicate some of their financing needs to some debt instruments, whether that's bank financing or whatever it is. But that is always a need for an entrepreneur.
And do you help them with that as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's our second primary service. So we do that on a daily basis, and we actually have two full-time people that are just helping companies raise money.
You must have a lot of companies come to you that you evaluate quickly and say there's no real growth potential here. This is a business primarily to generate an income for its owner. And I presume you don't provide a lot of help to that kind of business. Is that true?
That's totally true. And what that is a lifestyle entrepreneur, which are wonderful, and that is actually the cornerstone of the economy. You know, 90% of the businesses in America are small business, and like 80% of those are sole proprietors. We do not work with lifestyle entrepreneurs. That's not to, you know, mean we don't value them, but our greatest value is actually helping high-growth entrepreneurs who are actually employing people.
How do you see quickly which proposals are lifestyle businesses and which have real growth potential?
We have a screening mechanism. So first of all, if you don't fall within those four sectors that we talked about, four or five sectors, we're generally going to refer you to another resource. So we'll always refer an entrepreneur. So that's a natural screening mechanism. You know, the other thing for me is just based on, you know, our history of working with entrepreneurs. If you do not have a hiring plan in place as part of your business model, we'll generally assume that you're a lifestyle entrepreneur and, again, refer you out to other resources that might be more appropriate.
What sort of resume do you look for in an entrepreneur that you think has real growth potential?
For me, it's less the resume than it is a passion and a command of understanding of the market that they're pursuing. So if somebody is going in the retail market and they've come from another industry that might be service sector, I'm going to want to see how they're compensating for that gap on their resume. So often it's something that's specific to the market that they're going after. But for me, a lot of it can't be captured in a resume. A lot of it has to do with passion. What's your appetite for risk, and can you sell? Those are the three things that I really evaluate entrepreneurs on when they're pursuing a business model.
So knowledge of the market, appetite for risk, and the ability to sell.
Right. If you can't sell, you can't be an entrepreneur. That's the bottom line. That's one thing I've learned in my life.
So those are the characteristics of a successful entrepreneur?
I think so. And then there's one other that I like to add. I always like to know, you know, I was taught by a great mentor, Larry Levy, who's run Levy Restaurants, which is a huge organization in Chicago. And he always said he became a much better entrepreneur when he learned to hire people around him that were better than himself, mm-hmm. or not afraid to hire people, the best people you can. And often entrepreneurs, that means that they have to drop their egos and they have to have a sense of humility and not be afraid to do what's in the best interest of the company. And I always say the greatest title an entrepreneur can have is founder. That may mean you're not the CEO. And oftentimes you might have the great wherewithal to start a business, but not the best person to run the business. So that's the last characteristic.
What role do new business incubators play in encouraging entrepreneurship and business growth? It seems like every city now has one or two or three, and I'm curious what your experience has been with those business incubators in terms of the contribution they make to the growth of new businesses.
I'm a little skeptical, and I've been a big supporter of incubators. I think they work in certain industries where there's a lot of need for collaboration and need for proximity. So incubators around technology and biotechnology, there's an importance of proximity and sharing of information seem to work. But I just don't know if incubators, because one, they're false economies, if you know what I mean. Businesses have to learn how to make their way on their own. So while incubators are very good for starting businesses, soon companies have to graduate from them. So, you know, I just have not seen great success with incubators. And it's not to mean that they're not important. I just think the jury's still out on them.
One of the concerns we've discussed on Smart City repeatedly is the decline of the kinds of businesses that make cities distinct, small independent retailers and restaurants. I mean, that's what defines one city versus another. And you've worked, of course, two of the sectors that you focus on are retail and restaurant. So you've worked with a number of those businesses starting up in Chicago. Tell me about those businesses and what makes them successful.
Well, I'll tell you what, that has been a great hallmark of Chicago. One, Chicago has a diverse industry base, which I think makes us a very strong and robust city because the economy affects certain sectors differently. So anyways, with regards to retail and restaurants, we have seen an emergence of some really neat entrepreneurial endeavors. You know, one example, and I always like anchoring my comments around specifics. So, you know, one example is this company, Argo Tea, that basically provides an alternative to Starbucks and coffee, and that's, you know, healthy alternative teas. And they've gone from one retail site in Lincoln Park to five now, and they've gone from one employee to 80. So you want to talk about economic impact, and also their storefronts really make up a part of the city, and you and I talked about this. You know, one of them is located in the theater district downtown, and it's really kind of among all the theaters, then you've got this wonderful new retail outlet, Argo Tea, and they've really done a great job of actually creating a presence on the street as well as providing great services and employing people, and I think that's very unique. And that's part of the history of America and for sure the history of Chicago. So we're seeing some great activity both in the retail and always restaurants coming in and out of the business. So they're a little bit different than retail because you see them come and go, as we know, Carol. But in this town, specifically Chicago, which is a very friendly town to restaurants, they often make up the character of the neighborhood as well as providing a great place for people to go and enjoy themselves.
Argo Tea was started by an immigrant?
Yes, actually Arsen Arkvinian. He is Armenian, and I'm not sure how many years he's been over here, but he loves tea, and where he's from, tea is very important. So I love that because we talk about his resume, right? So he had no history of working in the tea industry. He just had a passion and a true command of understanding of the potential or the depth of the market. He really thought through the concept. You know, he's one of my favorite entrepreneurs in Chicago. He's a pure risk taker, and as you and I have discussed, to go from 1 to 5 locations is a huge strain on an individual. And this guy's probably working at least 20 hours a day, but he's making a huge difference. And he is an immigrant, and America's filled of immigrants, and Chicago has a great share of them. And he's a great story in Chicago.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is David Weinstein. He's CEO of Chicagoland Entrepreneurial Center. You focus on restaurants. You talked about the risk involved in restaurants, and we've all seen our favorite restaurant looks like it's doing great. It comes, it closes. So how do you assess risk in a startup restaurant?
In that specific industry, the risk threshold is just naturally high because people's preferences really do change at times. So you have to really, with a restaurant, there's a couple of things that are very important. You know, one, the amount of work that it actually takes to run the business, the amount of time commitment from an entrepreneur is tantamount to and directly correlated to the success. Also, a unique concept. And if you screw up one meal, that person's not coming back. So the sense of customer service is at such a high level, and consistency is so important. And I think we all know that every now and then we might miss on that. And so that's a huge challenge for restaurants. And actually, that's why I think that successful restaurateurs are great entrepreneurs, because they deal with consistency and constantly dealing with customer service.
So many cities would like to encourage independent retail, independent restaurant clustering in neighborhoods that become in themselves attractors to the neighborhood and overall to the city. In fact, I was rereading the other night a traveler piece on Chicago and noticed how much of the piece was focused on Chicago's retail shops and restaurants. And so clearly, urban leaders want to encourage this kind of activity. If you were advising an urban leader, let's say a mayor, on how he or she could encourage that kind of activity in their city, what would you say to them?
Well, fortunately in Chicago, Mayor Daley has really been wonderful around this industry because he understands it. And what I would advise any urban leader is to create information resources that make it easy for restaurateurs to deal with the things that are distractions, like permits, like licensing things that can actually distract them from running their business and putting together great food. And often a restaurateur might get sidetracked for days dealing with some of these requirements that any city will have, mainly to look out for the public health interest. And Mayor Daley's actually done a wonderful thing. He's actually created a restaurant wizard, if you can believe that, which actually provides quick information for people thinking about starting or running current restaurants on what things they need to have in place to operate a business in Chicago. That is a great example for other urban leaders to follow. And Mayor Daley's really been a leader in that front.
Now, when you say a restaurant wizard, is that online?
Yes, thank you. It is online, and it's very easy information, and actually, it has a search box, so a restaurateur can say, where do I go to get this license, and it'll automatically point you in that right direction, because as you and I know, often finding out how to navigate what you need to operate a business, could be a lot of information, and again, very distracting.
You've also made the point with me that an urban leader who simply shows an interest in an entrepreneur, in an independent retailer, restaurateur, that can be a very powerful experience for an entrepreneur.
Yeah, as you and I talked, I give you the example of when Argo Tea got a chance to actually sit down with the mayor and to watch this guy who's taken everything that he has and put it in his business. And really, every day, he's risking everything he has in running Argo Tea. And actually, to sit down with the leader of the city and listen to the mayor understand what's important to him. Example, like the mayor supported him in getting signage that was really important for him to help attract people walking on the street to come into the restaurant. So the fact that he actually got it made a huge impact on this entrepreneur. And I really do think that's important. And I think other urban leaders, they really need to focus. Entrepreneurs are the drivers of the economy. 70% of all new job growth is created by entrepreneurs. So you really have to have an understanding of it. And if you don't, you better have somebody on your staff that really understands the specific needs of entrepreneurs, which are far different, Carol, as we've talked about, than huge or large corporations.
You're one of the civic assets in Chicago now that is being used to encourage entrepreneurship. Are there others?
In Chicago, there most definitely are. One of the benefits of having a city with a rich history is we also have a rich history of entrepreneurship. And like I had mentioned, Larry Levy, we have examples of successful restaurateur and retail models that have grown, like Marshall Fields, right? And I think that makes a huge difference. And so part of that also is infused in the civic community of Chicago. You know, people like Paul O'Connor at World Business Chicago, Lori Healy at the Department of Planning and Development at the city. These people really understand business, and they're great civic assets. And every day they're thinking about how can I make the environment better for business. And I think that in itself is a huge benefit for people thinking about starting or running businesses in Chicago.
Do entrepreneurs tend to cluster geographically?
I don't think so. I think they cluster. If there's an industrial park, clearly there's going to be industrial businesses. But I think it depends on the layout of the city. So, and again, I know we're talking about cities. So in Chicago, you've got retail and restaurant quarters that are all over, and they're ubiquitous. But the professional service sector of Chicago is highly based in downtown. It also exists in other neighborhoods. So I think that businesses cluster around neighborhoods, but I can't say that specific sectors cluster. Maybe I'm not answering that so well. I think restaurants exist throughout all neighborhoods in Chicago, but I don't think that you see specific clustering occur aside of manufacturing or very targeted industries around certain quarters.
Do you think it's important that entrepreneurs be able to find each other, get support from each other?
I totally do. And, you know, the greatest thing for me is I have a peer group. You know, I have 15 fellow entrepreneurs, and we play poker together. And I know that sounds funny, but it's our time to actually come together. And entrepreneurs really do well from learning from one another. And the other thing, and you and I have talked about this, Carol, is I always talk about my mistakes. And that is one that's anti kind of a Western thought process. And for entrepreneurs, it's everything. So entrepreneurs love talking about the blind alleys that they've gone down, and they often enjoy doing that in peer groups. So without question, that is a unique characteristic of an entrepreneurial community, the fact that there's some sense of community.
Common wisdom holds that entrepreneurs are too busy building their businesses to involve themselves in civic matters. Is that what you find?
I don't, and that's something that you and I have talked about. I'm very passionate about. There's this common wisdom that you have to have had succeeded or made it to 60 or 70 years old before you can start giving back, and I just don't buy that. I think entrepreneurs live and play in the city that they run their business, and they often are very concerned with the civic vitality of the city because it's naturally linked to the success of their business. And I actually think linkages that allow entrepreneurs, whether they're 25, 40, 50, to actually participate in the planning and the civic participation of the city is critical to the success of an entrepreneurial community.
Do you think that you have to involve them differently or give them a different structure for involvement that takes special advantage or gives special attention to their limited time or the way their special skills and knowledge that they have to contribute?
Without question, Carolyn, and you know this because you've run a business, you cannot ask an entrepreneur to get involved in six different causes. You know, find one or two that's actually near and dear to their heart, something important. So, you know, an example in Chicago is all entrepreneurs are concerned about the school system. And I think the mayor's done a great job of engaging businesses in shaping some of the school curriculum and also involving our students because, after all, they're the future workforce. So I think things that are congruent congruent with an entrepreneur's passion are important, and an entrepreneur can't spread themselves too thin. So I think communities that try to ask entrepreneurs to do more than they can handle won't be successful, and you'll be like an inch deep and a mile wide.
Mm-hmm. What's next for the Chicagoland Entrepreneurial Center?
Two big things, and thank you for asking. Went to India about a month ago, and one of the big things for me is really thinking through how we can provide global resources for entrepreneurs. You got to act locally, but think globally. So one of the big things for me is, how do we help entrepreneurs begin to think about global strategies? So in the coming year, you're going to see us do more and more work. A number of our entrepreneurs are actually using labor forces and workforce in China and India to produce their products. For me, that's an old model. I want our entrepreneurs to sell their products and services into these new economies. Everybody talks about India. For me, what's more exciting about India is that there's 1.1 billion people, but 300 million in what they consider the middle class. These are buyers. So why aren't we selling our products here? So that's one. The second area is mentoring. We have a great program that does focus mentoring for women entrepreneurs. And in the coming year, we think it's so vital to expand that beyond and to address, you know, other minority first-time entrepreneurs as well as other specific sector entrepreneurs, because entrepreneurs need great advisors. You hear me mention always people who have been important in my life, and not just for when things are good, but more importantly, when you hit tough spots. And if we can't connect entrepreneurs with good advisors and mentors, they'll never be able to push the needle. So those are the two areas, both mentoring and thinking about globalization, that you'll see us pursue in 2006.
David, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Dan Weinstein is CEO of Chicagoland Entrepreneurial Center. I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. City View's commentator Walker Smith joins us weekly to give us his very personal view of life in cities.
Economists have long puzzled over voting because the time and effort it takes to vote exceed any personal utility. One vote rarely matters. Even worse, in some states, juries are recruited from voter registration lists. So in these states, voting carries an even bigger burden, which further weighs against it. It's not entirely clear what we as a nation think about voting. Some of the biggest moments in American history have involved fights over the vote, like the women's suffrage movement and the civil rights movement. And we champion our belief in democracy worldwide, fighting wars to depose dictators and sending in advisors and observers to facilitate free elections in other countries. Voting is woven tightly into our national fabric. Yet we ourselves are not particularly good role models. In national elections, only about half of those eligible vote. And in local elections, the percentage is much lower, typically in the low single digits. The so-called freak economists Stephen Dubner and Stephen Levitt recently wrote about this in the New York Times Magazine. They puzzled over the persistence of voting, light turnout notwithstanding. Part of the answer seemed to be revealed in an unintended natural experiment that occurred when mail-in ballots were introduced in Switzerland, a country with strong social norms for voting. Contrary to expectations that voting would increase when the time it took was significantly decreased, voting declined. Does this suggest that personal utility has nothing to do with voting? No, argued Dubner and Levitt, it's just that time is not the personal utility that matters most. In Switzerland, the tradition of voting is so strong that people wouldn't risk their social standing by not being seen at the polls. But with mail-in ballots, voting declined because there was no longer any risk to social esteem. Or to put it another way, with nothing forcing them to vote, the Swiss voted with their feet, that voting offered little to recommend it over other things they could do instead with that teeny bit of extra time. In fact, there is little that an economic perspective can ever recommend for voting. Our commitment to voting must come from a different imperative, one of ethics and philosophy. We must vote because it is the right thing to do, and because we should act in the way we believe that everyone should act. This is not about personal utilities. This is about duties and obligations beyond utilities. Yet in a culture engrossed with consumerism and overarching concerns about what's in it for me, such imperatives seem archaic and unreasonable. Personal utilities make sense in the marketplace, but they are out of place elsewhere. Every decision is not a simple calculus of value for the money and time spent. Some decisions are deeper and more fundamental, and this is true of many decisions about our communities, from voting to joining to volunteering to caring. Duties we owe well before we start to add up our individual returns. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to sign up for podcasts of our show and register for our weekly newsletter. You can also find archive shows at our site. Our theme music was composed and performed by Memphis musicians Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage, with additional music by Christopher Reyes. Candace Ludlow edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and communities.